From the Arizona Daily Star and Tucson.com, this is the Wildcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Wildcast Podcast. I'm Justin Spears here with Dominic Pachaco and Bruce Pasco, and we're part of the Arizona Daily Star, and every week, whether it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday, we always kind of change up the schedule depending on Arizona's press conferences. But every week before home games, an Arizona basketball home game, we do a live podcast at Frog and Firkin. And have we done one since the new year?
I don't think so. Just one?
We've only done once in 2019. So this is podcast number two for the Colorado game. That's right. So this is podcast number two in 2019. And by the way, you can listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can download the Wildcaster app that's available on the App Store and Google Play. And of course, special thanks to Frog and Firkin on University for always hosting the Wildcast podcast. Guys, Arizona basketball, they're 4-0 right now. I gotta get Bruce Pasco your take. What do you think about the Wildcats so far? They're undefeated in conference play. They look solid right now, but like we've said before, Pac-12 is kind of down right now.
Yeah, I mean, this was the soft part of their schedule, but I think the impressive thing is the way they pulled out those games against Utah and Stanford and just getting it done, finding a way to get it done. There's a lot to be said for that. You know, this is a team that's got some issues just like every team in the Pac-12 does this year. It's not a great league this year, but they put themselves in a position to make a run for it, even though the schedule gets tougher here. At least to date, they've done everything they could possibly do.
But the biggest headline coming out of Arizona this week, obviously the transfer of Emmanuel Acott. He's the former five-star forward that a lot of people had high expectations for. You almost thought the way Sean Miller talked about him, he could maybe turn into this Rondae Hollis-Jefferson role because he could be a solid defensive player, but we've also heard Sean Miller talk about he's one of the team's best passers. And since Ryan Luther was dealing with that hand injury and going through some things, they put Emmanuel Acott into the starting lineup. And then after Arizona swept Cal and Stanford on the road, Acott announced to the team on Sunday that he was going to take his talents elsewhere and he's going to transfer. Bruce, how do you assess, and Dom, you can jump in as well. How do you guys assess this situation? Because it's kind of weird timing because you're right in the middle of the season and Emmanuel Acott's a starter. It's not like he's sitting on the bench and Sean Miller, you know, reduces his lineup to eight guys or whatever. He's a starter. He's getting starting minutes. So why does Emmanuel Acott transfer right now?
Well, there's two things about it. I mean, he was a starter, but they were reducing his role. He didn't play at the end at Stanford, and Ira Lee was the hero of that game. I think maybe he saw kind of writing on the wall there that he was going to be used less in those situations. But I also think there was when he started after the Maui tournament and they took Ryan Luther out of the lineup, maybe that was a move to get some shooting on the bench. The bench scoring was a problem at that point. But it also could signify that at that point, Acott was unhappy, and Miller described it as he was lacking confidence and wanted to start him for that reason. So they experimented with it for the last 11 games, and clearly it didn't work out. I mean, the weird thing is about it, the timing. The only reason you transfer usually in midseason is so you can go somewhere immediately in the spring and be eligible after the fall semester the next season, so you don't have to set out a whole year. You lose a little bit of eligibility, but that's what usually guys do when they transfer midseason. If you transfer midseason and just stay at school and quit, that usually signals you don't see any value in your playing the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. So you can draw a conclusion about that.
And Sean Miller even said after, what was it, the Stanford game last week, that he wanted to get Ira Lee more minutes with Chase Jeter on the floor. That would mean that Acott is going to see less minutes. So maybe, I mean, for all we know, Sean Miller could have even signaled a change behind closed doors, and we might never know that, but he might have, you know, he might have had that conversation with Acott or Lee or whoever it might have been and said, look, this is the direction we're going. And to be frank, it's probably a better option. I like Ira Lee in the starting lineup. I like him, even though Luther is probably going to get the start this week against Oregon.
Yeah, Ryan Luther's starting.
I like Ira Lee in there. I think he needs more minutes with Chase Jeter. They're two of the team's top rebounders, and I think with Ira Lee on the floor with Chase Jeter, it brings a lot more to the court than Acott was offering. Acott's prospects obviously were high coming into Arizona, but he hadn't put out in the last year and a half, specifically the last few games as a starter. And Ira Lee off the bench, too, is an interesting prospect at coming in after Ryan Luther because he's a better scorer, I think, than Ryan Luther is. And bringing that off the bench, I think, helps Arizona in the long run, too.
It depends on what form of scoring. Because Ryan Luther's a better shooter than Ira Lee, mm-hmm. and we've seen that. He's able to knock down some three-pointers and able to kind of add a spark off the bench. But Ira Lee, at the same time, we saw what we did on the road against Stanford, closing out the game, being the hero, the kind of the clutch guy that was able to knock down free throws and also not get into foul trouble late in the game because people forget Chase Jeter fouled out of that game. Well, and Ira Lee,
Stanford was getting everybody in foul trouble. Yeah. That's what Stanford does.
Yeah. But Ira Lee was able to come in with three fouls, replace Chase Jeter, and Sean Miller even said that in yesterday's press conference. He's really molded into this role that he comes in for Jeter and replaces him, and he does such a good job of doing it.
Well, now Miller says he wants to play Jeter and Lee together, which kind of hints that maybe he wants him to start at some point. But you're right, they'll probably start with Luther to begin with. We'll see, though. But he described it more as a... a rebounding thing, that he was kind of intrigued by putting his best two-per-minute rebounders in there together and seeing if they can really clean up, especially off on the offensive boards, and make some things happen that way. And I think that speaks to the fact that Jeter's certainly getting more comfortable offensively and doing some things, but you know, if they can create baskets by offensive rebounding, inside like that, that might be their best thing, that and, as he spoke, in taking care of the ball, because they're not great offensive players around the basket.
Bruce, Sean Miller said something interesting at yesterday's press conference that I want to ask you about. And when Emmanuel Aycott was still here, obviously, especially leading up to this year and through last year when he was a freshman and not getting starters minutes, Miller hyped up Emmanuel Aycott's defense a lot. yeah. I mean, Emmanuel Aycott was in the starting lineup this year, you could argue, because of his defense and what he brought to that side of the ball. Now that he's gone, it was the first time I had seen him say it. Maybe, Bruce, you can attest to this, but I heard Sean Miller call Dylan Smith the team's best defender.
Yeah. No, he has.
Has that been the case all year, and will that be the case moving forward? Can they kind of lean on Dylan Smith to be a defensive stopper?
Yeah, they're going to have to. I mean, he's actually said that about a month ago. He started saying that, and, I think it's probably true in the context of the defenders they have. I mean, his effort's really good, and he's long. He's experienced. He's smart. On the court, he knows where to be, and he can cause problems even for guys that are a little bit bigger than him. So, that is kind of a key. And it was interesting to me how he sprinkled him in briefly at the four over the weekend, and it sounds like now he's going to do that a little bit more, especially against teams like Oregon that go with smaller front courts a lot. And that could be really key if he can handle that.
Is that going to hurt him down the stretch? Because I know the Pac-12 does that a lot. And like you said, Sean Miller talked about it yesterday, how a lot of lineups in the Pac-12 are kind of smaller, and where you can afford to play a 6'5 Dylan Smith at the four spot. Is that going to hurt them if they get, after Pac-12 play, if they get into the tournament and face a team that's bigger and, obviously has more size than a 6'5, small
he's
forward.
He's a shooting guard.
Small forward slash guard playing the four.
Yeah, but I also think that this is what they have, and I'm thinking if I were Arizona, I'd be thinking you just want to see if you can make a run and win the Pac-12, and whatever happens after that, great. But there may not be much after that if they don't win the Pac-12, because the power ratings are so low for everybody.
And that was Sean Miller's comment yesterday, was quote unquote, these are our circumstances, this is what we're playing with, and if that's Dylan Smith at the four, if that's what makes him helps him win games in the Pac-12, and that's what they have to do.
Usually, Sean Miller said this, that the month of, was it November, December, usually the most important months of Arizona, because I think he said that because he wants to experiment different lineups. He wants to see what kind of looks and what kind of works best for him. I'm curious to see now moving forward, is he still going to experiment different lineups even though that he's in Pac-12 play? You know this, Dom. You're a Golden State Warriors fan. Was it the lineup of death or the death lineup? Draymond Green's the starting center, and he's, 6'7" or something like that?
Not on Fridays, not anymore.
So, but could you see a situation where you would have maybe an Ira Lee playing center, playing small ball five, and maybe have a Dylan Smith at the four, and then plug in the other guys like a Brandon Randolph, Brandon Williams, and a Justin Coleman?
I mean, that's what he did briefly against Stanford at the end, after Jeter had fouled out. Yeah.
And a lot of it's just going to come down to foul trouble. Like when Jeter fouled out. Who's your center after Jeter fouls out? It's Ira Lee. and then you can play Luther at the four and Dylan Smith at the three, or, you know, however you want to play it. The thing with Aycott is it hurts the depth. So
yeah.
Ira Lee or guys like him need to step up and play center because they don't have anyone else. I mean, how thin they are down low in the post now is going to be glaring, and it'll be glaring quick. I mean, if they get in foul trouble against Orion, you're going to see it. And, you know, if Ira Lee gets in foul trouble and Chase Geary gets in foul trouble, then they're really in trouble because then Ryan Luther's your center. Then Dylan Smith not only has to play for, not only is playing for, he has to play for because he's the next man up. Mm-hmm.
Real quick, so now that Emmanuel Aycott's transferring, Bruce Pascoe created a gallery of, you know, the transfers under Sean Miller, and which is available on Tucson.com and the Wildcaster app. Dom, you were able to, you know, put this together and make it all nice and pretty. When you look at the transfers in Arizona basketball history, you always look at the next steps. Bruce, when you look at the history of transfers, who was the one that was able to be successful at the next stop? I know Angelo Chole did a decent job, or at least had some role with San Diego State. I know Momo Jones did pretty well at Iona. I'm just trying to think of, you know, transfers in the past that are doing well. Look at Justin Simon with what he's doing at St. John's.
Yeah, I think Justin Simon and Daniel Bejarano going to Colorado State, probably the two most successful careers after transferring from Arizona. And, you know, honestly, they haven't – Dom and I were talking about this last night. It's actually difficult to really quantify because a lot of guys now just leave for pros when they probably would be candidates to transfer back in, you know, a decade or so ago. You know, especially now with two-way contracts and more opportunities, guys just leave. Like Chance Comanche, for example. He's a guy who basically transferred for all intents and purposes. Grant Jarrett got drafted, but kind of you could argue he maybe transferred because Aaron Gordon was coming in and he wasn't starting over Brandon Nashley. I mean, there's things like that that have happened. There's a number of guys who fit that category. Mm-hmm. But as far as actual transfers, yeah, those two guys probably, and Momo Jones being, you know, he was being the same Momo Jones when he went to Iona, just scoring a heck of a lot of points.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, what is Josiah Turner up to these days? Is he still playing overseas?
Jeez.
Is he playing basketball?
I have not checked up on him in the last few years. I mean, last
it's 2019, heard... Dom. Check it out. What Josiah Turner's up to in 2019?
Well, because I know he started playing. I mean, because those are the kind of guys who, you know, people who transfer don't necessarily pan out, like we said. I mean, Justin Simon is really the only one under Sean Miller who has had success transferring to another college school. But Josiah Turner was kind of an interesting case because he was transferring and then went overseas or to play in Canada. Sometimes that works out.
He was a complicated issue because it was so much about off-the-court issues with him. It literally wasn't about basketball. He actually was a very talented point guard, and that's why Sean Miller recruited him. But he had a lot of issues off the court, and, you know, it didn't have his act together, and, you know, it was playing in Canada. And I remember, you know, he had that extreme DUI, and they were trying to pull him down to a certain level because if you have, I think, a certain level of DUI, you can't even go to Canada, much less play there. So there was, I mean, he's just had a lot of issues, and he's bounced around a couple times. He may be somewhere right now. I'm not sure, honestly.
The official Josiah Turner podcast.
Thought I'd ask. Weirdest... Maybe he's still playing overseas. Maybe we knew something. I don't know.
Speaking of weird things in 2019, is it bad to say that Oregon State is a dark horse to win the Pac-12? And I know they're. You look at the roster, they may not be the super most talented team in the conference, but Pac-12 is down this year. I like what I see out of the Thompson brothers. I like what I see out of Kyler Kelly, who leads the league in blocks. What do you have against USC? Wasn't like 7 blocks? And one of them was pretty much the game-winning block or the game-saving block on USC freshman who's now suspended, Kevin Porter. He's a guy that I think is going to be an X factor this week against Arizona. I think Oregon State's a dark horse to win the Pac-12. Am I crazy?
To win the Pac-12, yes, you're a little bit crazy. I think they're going to compete. I mean, I think they have a bye in the Pac-12 tournament, and it's just, I mean, how long can they keep competing? They've never had a road sweep in the Pac-12 era, you know, since Colorado and Utah came along. That's going to be put to the test this week in Tempe and Tucson. So I think they're definitely going to compete. They're one of the best teams in the Pac-12, and that says something more about the Pac-12 than it does OSU. But they have talent. I mean, they have as much talent as, you know, the next best team in the Pac-12, and they're one of three undefeateds left right now. So I think they're worthy of a couple extra looks, some more time in the film room.
I actually think they were kind of a dark horse even entering the season, but I didn't think they would get in that top four because I didn't think they had much depth behind the Thompson brothers and
Tinkle.
Tinkle. But what's interesting, what's jumped out at me is just their depth that they've found out of these guys and Kelly. I'd heard that Kelly was a big, skinny, huge shot blocker in junior college and NAIA, but, you know, you never really know how that's going to translate. And so he's been better than expected. And then they've had some role players really step up for him. I think Tinkle's been, you know, dealing with an ankle problem or something, and guys have filled in around him. And then to win at Eugene, and granted that's not, you know, like a really far road trip or anything, but just to win in that building is it says something too. So they're definitely a team to watch.
When we talked about Arizona's kind of lack of experience outside of, you know, the two transfers that came in this year at the beginning of the year, Oregon State has that. I mean, they have their best players. Tinkle is a junior, if I'm not mistaken, and then you look at Stephen Thompson, who's a senior, and Wayne Tinkle's been coaching these guys for a few years, and now they're kind of getting going. And in a year that the Pac-12 is down, it's really showing that you know, these guys have some experience, and they're going to beat up on teams that aren't as prepared as them.
And that's what's so funny. Like, every year we get caught up in who's new, who's the big five-star freshman, and all this new talent coming in, and this team's going to be great. You always have to look at the teams that have a lot of guys coming back. That's why Oregon State was scary with those three guys. But I didn't think they had the depth. But combining that with those experience, you just don't see that anymore. Because, I mean, basically, Trace Tinkle's he's a fourth-year player. He just was hurt 1 year. So you have those two guys who've been playing for Wayne Tinkle for four seasons now. Ethan Thompson, a couple seasons, and some pretty experienced role players. And then they get a JUCO shot blocker in there. It's like, wow, all of a sudden, they're really something.
I know he hasn't been there for more than a couple of years, but could you put Washington in that same category under Mike Hopkins? I know a lot of those guys, they're all, especially the senior class, they're all Romar's guys. But Mike Hopkins has been coaching these guys for a couple of years, and they're all upperclassmen for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, they were picked, I don't remember the official poll. I know I had them third, and then when I kind of redid it, after the non-conference, I kind of thought they'd be the favorite, and especially considering, not only that they have everybody back, but the defense they play is tough to deal with, and you know, their schedule. Frankly, they got a break on their schedule too, not having to have Arizona and ASU go up there, among other things, or not having to play them twice. And I think they have another break. I can't think of off the top of my head, but their schedule kind of looks like the easiest as far as that goes.
It's crazy that we're in a time in Pac-12 play. Or we're at an era in the Pac-12 where Oregon State is one of the four favorites. I mean, I think right now you could probably put Arizona and Washington atop any Pac-12 power rankings that you wanted to do. Oregon State has to be in the conversation. I mean, they're three or four. And then it's kind of a potpourri of who's next between, you know, UCLA, USC, ASU, I think is still going to be competitive. They have the talent. It's just kind of, you know, everything in the Pac-12 is up in the air, and that's why it's good that Arizona, Washington, and Oregon State have gotten out to the starts that they have, because you're going to need it. I mean, sooner or later, this conference is going to start beating up on each other. I don't see anyone running away with it. I think you're going to see you might see this pack kind of break off where it's Arizona, Washington, Oregon State, and maybe another team. But, I mean, Pac-12 is competitive at the very least for you know, as down of a year as it is. They're going to be competitive up top.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking ahead to this week, Arizona's got Oregon on Thursday night, which will be televised on ESPN. Tip-off set for 7 p.m. You can also follow the Wildcaster for live in-game updates. But Oregon's on Thursday, and then Oregon State's on Saturday. I presume how much we're hyping up Oregon State right now, that the Beavers are probably going to be Arizona's toughest challenge this week, which is something I don't think I've ever said as long as Dane Altman's the head coach at Oregon.
Well, I think both games are going to be probably tougher. They could be tougher than any of the four they previously played. Because Oregon State, for the reasons we've been talking about, and Oregon is starting to look like, you know, the team that they were expected to be. They're still, you know, they lost Bowl Bowl, and that's, you know, that's going to undoubtedly keep hurting them. You can't put a price on that, but Lewis King is starting to look like the Lewis King we expected he would be. He's extremely dangerous, can hurt you in a number of different ways. And, you know, they always play kind of a confusing defense to adjust to, where they're constantly switching man-to-man zone, trapping, this and that, and that's caused Arizona problems sometimes and a lot of other teams for the reason. However, we saw the way they melted down against UCLA, and And that was a weak spot too. So you know they're not there yet, but they've got a lot of elements, and they could at the end of the day, especially they may get Kenny Wooten back this weekend. If not, then maybe another week or two. They could still make a run for this conference. Mm.
And that's the thing. I mean, I said nobody's running away from it. I mean, if Oregon can stay in the hunt, they're going to be right there at the end of the year because they have the talent. If everyone can come back healthy, obviously with the exception of Bol Bol, who's done for the year. But Kenny Wooten's a talented player. And, I mean, Lewis King probably in the discussion for Pac-12 Player of the Year early on. Mm-hmm. And between him and Tinkle, you have two candidates, probably the top two candidates, mate. Well, with the exception of players at ASU, two of the top candidates for Player of the Year coming into Arizona this week.
That's true. Yep.
All right, guys. So answer these questions right here, okay? Arizona, let's just say, they take care of business at home against the Oregon schools. They sweep them. And to keep it realistic, they split on the road against UCLA and USC. Does Arizona win the Pac-12 after that? I know it's not official that they're winning the conference, mm-hmm. but do you have enough confidence in saying if they were to win these two games this week and split on the road next week in L.A., are they the winners of the Pac-12?
No, I think it's still too early.
Okay.
I mean, like Dom said, nobody's going to run away with it. It's hard to imagine. I mean, granted, if there's, you know what, if they're 7-1 and everybody else has three losses, then, of course, that's a two-game advantage that would be pretty huge, and maybe you could hang on to that. But there's, you know, the back half of their schedule, you know, it's pretty tough, and they've got to end up with a road trip at in Oregon. They've still got to go to the mountain schools, and then they play ASU at home the last game of the season. So it's, you know, it's probably a little premature, but certainly, again, if they can get that to that point, that's a great position to be in, and they have a really good shot at it. But
what Arizona's done in the first 2 weeks in Pac-12 play is establish themselves as the team to beat still in the Pac-12. Even in a down year, when everybody in the Pac-12 is down, Arizona is still the team to beat at 4-0. You know, they're the favorite in every game they play. They're never going to be the underdogs this year, as of now, at least. You know, maybe if they lose a couple games down this, early on here, they might be. But they're not going to be the underdog. They're the team to beat in the Pac-12. And if they sweep Oregon schools this week, split the L.A. road trip, it'll depend what happens with ASU. I think that's still going to be a tough matchup for Arizona. I know Sean Miller's never lost to ASU since Bobby Hurley's been there, but I think they're still going to present some challenges in the Pac-12 this year. And if Oregon's going to hang around, I think ASU can still hang around because they're one of the most talented, if not the most talented team in the Pac-12. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. So I want to play a little semi-game with you guys right here, okay? You know the popular social media trend, the 10-year challenge, people posting photos of themselves from 2009 and then comparing it to a photo in 2019. I went back and looked at Arizona's schedule in Sean Miller's first year, which is 10 years ago, and coincidentally, Arizona played the Oregon schools on this week 10 years ago. So I'm gonna quiz you guys right here, okay? Don't look at your laptops. You'll start Googling. So Arizona, they beat Oregon in Eugene 74-60, and this is Sean Miller's first year. Can you guys name five players from Oregon's team?
We're talking about
the 2009
Miller's first year, 9-10. That was not
9-10 against Oregon.
It's five players from Oregon.
Five players from Oregon.
Bruce is going to be a lot better at this than I am.
We'll reduce it down to three. Can you name any three players from Oregon's team at that point?
It would be 2010, right?
Yes. So this is Derek Williams, his freshman year. Nick Wise was a senior point guard, playing for his fourth head coach in 4 years. Kyle Fogg was still around. Jamel Horn was still around.
Well before
Kevin Parham, Solomon Hill. Those guys were all in their freshman year.
It's well before Dylan Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and those were kind of some
bad Oregon teams.
Yeah, I mean, the teams you remember are the really good Ernie Kent teams in, like, the early 2000s, mid-2000s. To be honest, off the top of my head, I mean, there's been so much transition, and those weren't great teams, I don't believe. You know, without looking at something, I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Justin, you stumped us.
So I'll give you...
Could you have, if I had told you to do this?
No. I couldn't have done it.
You know Ryan. Ryan Finley.
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you a hint. One of them had a brother that played at Duke.
When did he play at Duke?
In the mid late 2000s. And his last name. Okay, it's the opposite of Doubler.
Oh, Singler.
Yeah, Singler.
So it wasn't Kyle Singler. It was Kyle Singler's brother?
Yeah.
AJ or
EJ. EJ yeah. Singler. Yeah. Okay. I'll just list off some names right here. Michael Dunnigan, Teandre Williams, EJ Singler, Jamil Wilson, and Garrett Sim. With LeKendrick Longmire, Malcolm Armstead.
LeKendrick Longmire. Get out of here with these names right
now. Malcolm Armstead, Tawan Porter, and Jeremy Jacob.
Tawan Porter.
That was Oregon's team.
He was a talent, and Sim was a gritty local kid that everybody loved, and that was about all that you remember that team.
Yeah,
we didn't even remember.
Maybe if you're an Oregon fan.
What is this? Okay, just one.
I think we've just lost anybody who.
One player from Oregon State, because they also lost to them 67-64. So, can you name one player from Oregon State
in 2010?
Yeah, 2010 they lost to Oregon State 67-64 on the road.
No.
You can't name one player from... I could have, just because...
That was before Wayne Tinkle.
Yeah,
right.
So, that was before Gary Payton, of course.
Roland Schaftenaar.
Roland Schaftenaar.
I could have guessed
on
that.
On list of names...
I could have guessed that.
They had a streak of about 6 years earlier where they always had a Schaftenaar because they had his brother, Roland, and then I think Omar or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. They were the
big Dutch 6'10" stretch shooters. Yeah.
They were the, he said, like they always had brothers. They were kind of like the watered down Plumlee brothers over at Duke. But, okay, so can you name anybody from Arizona's team? Can you name the starting five from that Arizona team?
Didn't you name a couple seconds? I mean, you had Solomon Hill,
Nick Wise, Jamel Horn.
Jamel Horn start that year in 2010?
And Solomon Hill.
And Derek Williams. You're talking about the first year?
Derek Williams started after
the first two games, I think.
All right, guys. Real quick, so we only have a couple minutes left here. We got to answer Twitter mailbag questions. Dom, you have up the questions right now.
I do.
So every week, we always, whenever we do this podcast, we always answer Twitter mailbag questions. Or if you go on to the Wildcaster app, there's a comment tool, and you can actually record yourself asking a question or a comment, and which will air on the podcast. Dominic, you have the questions up right now. Which one's number one?
We'll go with this one first. Men's basketball, does Emmanuel Aycott leaving bode well for all the guys we have coming in next season? This is from Arizona Wild Bags. Bruce, I know you talked about this in your main article in today's Arizona Daily Star. What it does for scholarship wise, they're right now under the 13 maximum that you can have. If Zeke were to sign, it would put them back over it again. What does Emmanuel Aycott do for next year's team?
Well, I think besides the recruiting aspects of it, it basically just clears up playing time, and that's a good thing. You know, I think in the old school sense, you might think you want Aycott there to provide extra competition for guys like Zeke Nagy and Terry Armstrong coming in. But unfortunately, that in this day and age, that always leads to guys leaving or whatever. And so now maybe you've got a little more clearance there, and they're still going to have guys to compete against in practice. It's not going to be too big a deal that way. But I think it's possible that Aycott saw what was coming in next year and realized maybe he'd have an opportunity to be a bigger factor somewhere else. It's just, it's hard to say.
Well, that's a good point, too. Talking about Emmanuel Aycott leaving, we haven't really looked at next year's team. There's not going to be a lot of minutes to go around. There's a lot of talent coming in, and there's going to be a lot of talent left over from this year. So that's a good point. I mean, there's not... Would have Emmanuel Aycott been able to carve out the rest of this year? Would he been able to do enough to carve out a legitimate role next year? Probably not.
No. And you look at like you said, the scholarships. Mm-hmm. We always talked about, they have all these guys coming in, and a lot of them are probably going to be returning. Somebody's going to get their feelings hurt, and somebody's going to be asked to leave.
Yeah. But then again, you never know in the spring. There could still be more transition, and I asked Miller about that yesterday, and he said they're going to still keep recruiting because, this is a program. You just saw a starter transfer. You've had guys go to the Comanche declare for the draft who had no reason to believe they were going to get drafted. Guys can leave at any time for any reason now, so you just don't know. You do know pretty much who's coming in once they've signed the letter, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. One more question here before we sign off. Dirty Dingus McGee asks, Ari McDonald is... again, this is... This is women's basketball now. Ira McDonald is the best best basketball player on campus, but who are the players that need to step up to help the team be competitive in Pac-12 play? A tough stretch coming up here, a few ranked teams, Cal, Stanford. Not necessarily the best. Who's the most important player for Arizona to remain competitive, Justin?
For Arizona women's basketball?
Yes.
Outside of Ari McDonald. I would probably say either the other two transfers, mm-hmm. and Dominic McBride or T.T. Starks. Mm-hmm. Both of them transferred over from Power 5 schools. I think McBride was from Iowa State, if I'm not mistaken, or Purdue. And then T.T. Starks came over from Iowa State. T.T. actually comes off the bench. And she's been productive all year long for Arizona. So I look at those two players stepping up for the Wildcats moving forward in Pac-12 play. But it's so unfortunate because you saw with the game against Stanford, you know, they lost by 30 points. Mm-hmm. You know, they're there. They're right there, but they're not there at the same time. They're not considered the Stanfords. I know they upset Cal, but Cal is still a better overall team, whether you look mm-hmm. at it which way or another. But in terms of the Pac-12, and again, the Pac-12 is such an elite conference for women's basketball, Adia Barnes is going to have a hard time getting themselves up to that elite level, but they're definitely on the right track. I can't even remember when's the last time an Arizona women's basketball team has been relevant. Probably not since the Bonvicini days, right, Bruce?
When Adia Barnes was a player.
They
actually had, they had a couple good years maybe after that, but those were good teams in the late 90s or so.
I like Sam Thomas as the next most important player. She started in all 30 games for Arizona last year. She knows the system. She knows Adia Barnes. And Kate Reese is a name we haven't mentioned. I think Adia Barnes's development of Kate Reese is going to be pivotal for this Arizona basketball program over the next 4 years. But other people who can help Kate Reese develop as a player are people like Sam Thomas, who have experience. Again, she's only a sophomore, but she played and started in all 30 games for Arizona last year. Not many people have that kind of experience under Adia Barnes. So players like Sam Thomas will be critical, not only on the floor, but for developing the younger players off it.
And they're actually on the road against the Oregon schools. They'll take on Oregon State on Friday at 8 p.m. and also Oregon at Oregon in Eugene, and that will also be televised on Pac-12 networks, which will be on Sunday at 1 p.m.
Two top 10 teams.
Yeah, it's a challenge for them. And then Arizona on the men's side, they got Oregon on Thursday, which will be on ESPN, and then they got Oregon State on Saturday. You can follow the Wildcaster on Twitter for all of your live in-game coverage, and don't forget to give us a like on Facebook and Instagram. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Wildcast Podcast. Special thanks to Frog and Firkin for always hosting us, and we'll be back here shortly over the weekend as the Arizona Wildcats get ready to take on the Oregon schools. For Justin, or for Dom, for Bruce, I'm Justin. Thanks for listening.